Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scarsbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, as Pope Benedict is taking part in his yearly spiritual exercises in the Vatican, I'd like to shine the spotlight on this tradition. I'll then be looking ahead to the forthcoming 50th International Eucharistic Congress to be held in Dublin next June. By bringing you an interview on an all-new project involving young people, which has as theme, Go, be the Church with Christ and with one another. But first, I'd like you to step back in time with me to that first Eucharistic Congress held in Dublin back in 1932. The first Eucharistic Congress to be held in Dublin took place in June of 1932. It was to be an event so moving it would live on in the hearts and minds of Irish Catholics for generations to come. A moment described at the time in the media as a great Catholic festival with scenes of ecstatic religious fervour. On one occasion, Paramount News reported how in the festooned streets decorated with white flowers, the faithful knelt in adoration. As a solemn 4-mile procession, with the consecrated host carried high for all to see, wound its way to the sacramental pavilion at O'Connell Bridge. 80 years on, in his basic text on the forthcoming Dublin Eucharistic Congress, scheduled once again in this city in the month of June, from the 10th to the 17th, the current Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Martin, places this 1932 Congress into an historical context, explaining how it marked a moment of great religious accomplishment. Quote, "The event responded to the needs of piety which people felt at that moment. It responded to the need for affirmation of the Catholic community in Ireland, finding its way in the newly independent state. Today, Irish society has changed, and Irish piety has changed. People are hesitant about a sense of triumph in the public affirmation of their faith." Unquote. Archbishop Martin then highlights in this basic text how coming after the Civil War, which radically divided the people of Ireland, this Eucharistic Congress represented the first major national event which brought together both sides, thus pointing to how, at a national level, the event represented a strong moment of reconciliation. But why don't we step back in time for a moment to 1932? In those days, popes just didn't travel. They sent a representative to attend major events such as this one. And the Pope of the time, Pius XI, did exactly that. His choice fell on a cardinal of great distinction both at home and abroad, his name Lorenzo Lauri. It was to him that the Pope entrusted this message.
"Go to Ireland in my name, and say to the good people assembled there that the Holy Father loves Ireland and its inhabitants and visitors, and imparts not the usual apostolic blessing, but a very special, all-embracing one."
And the visitors Pius XI referred to there did come to Dublin, thousands of them from across the world, priests, nuns, and lay faithful. Perhaps too because many of these pilgrims were of Irish stock, and the Congress coincided with the 1,500th anniversary of St. Patrick's arrival on the Emerald Isle. What's certain is that reports of the time described how for 6 days Dublin became, in a sense, the hub of the Catholic world. Down at the port, a dozen or so ocean liners had moored, and pilgrims had poured out down the gangplanks. From all the continents they came, from Europe, of course, but also from further away. The United States and Canada, Latin America, Australia, some even came from China. Many of them had come to know Ireland through the Irish missionary presence in their home country. Let's recall, too, the importance Pius XI attributed to missionary zeal. Just listen to him speaking in Italian in praise of missionary zeal in a rather crackly radio message of that same year.
La figura del missionario cattolico irradia dei fulgidi splendori dell'eroismo.
You may be wondering how Dublin dealt with the arrival of these pilgrims. It seems from records of the time that it proved to be a welcoming city, for while many found lodgings in the liners acting as floating hotels, others were invited into the homes of Dubliners. There had even been mattress handouts on the part of the authorities. So extraordinary was the event that the government had passed a special act for the occasion. And on a more flashy note, local authorities had arranged for all the major buildings to be lit up at night by a series of powerful spotlights and coloured lamps. The highlight of this momentous occasion came on the final day of the Congress, as an estimated 1 million faithful gathered for an open-air Holy Mass in the 15-acre Phoenix Park. And the Pope, from Rome, lent his voice to the occasion, from the Vatican's Apostolic Library, through the microphones of Vatican Radio, for all to hear right across Dublin, through loudspeakers set up across the city. All could hear the announcer pronouncing these words in Latin, Attendite Beatissimus Pater, statim loquetur vobis. And all knelt as they understood the Holy Father's words were about to reach them. They expressed hope. We pray, he said, that God may grant you the gifts of unity and peace. Imparting his apostolic blessing over, he said, your, our beloved Ireland, and rest there forever. The atmosphere was described as quiet and prayerful. Many among the faithful donned badges, the smartest of which were manufactured in die-stamped brass with gilt coating and blue enamel, the text reading Internat Dublinensis Congresso Eucharistic. No doubt many Irish still treasure these in their homes today. Among the many visitors present on this occasion was English Catholic writer G.K. Chesterton, who wrote at the time,
I confess I was myself enough of an outsider to feel flash through my mind as the illimitable multitude began to melt away towards the gates and roads and bridges, the instantaneous thought, this is democracy, and everyone is saying there is no such thing.
Little did Chesterton know that many years later, the first and only pope ever to visit Ireland, the now blessed John Paul II, would stand tall in this very same park and preside over Holy Mass in this very same spot, stressing that spiritual union between generations in Ireland, who have, he said, done God's will through the ages up to the present day.
We are one in faith and spirit with the vast throng which filled this Phoenix Park on the occasion of the last great Eucharistic hosting held on this spot at the Eucharistic Congress in 1932.
And now looking ahead to the forthcoming 2012 June Eucharistic Congress, I'd like to quote once again from the Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Martin's basic text of the Dublin Eucharistic Congress, the passage therein where he points as to how it too takes place at another crucial moment in the history of Ireland and of the Irish Church. Quote, the Irish Church is in many ways a wounded church and a church which seeks a new direction. Like many European countries, Ireland has undergone rapid social change in these years. Ireland has become a highly secularised society. Unquote. And again, further on in this text, touching on the recent scandal of sexual abuse of children by priests and religious in Ireland, Archbishop Martin says, quote, this scandal has damaged the faith of many who feel robbed of their faith and feel betrayed by their church. This is so also of many of those who were abused and feel that a spiritual renewal should be an essential part of the healing process." Unquote. And with the Archbishop of Dublin's words there still ringing in our ears, I'd now like to look ahead to this 50th forthcoming International Eucharistic Congress mentioned by him. So stay tuned, as I'm about to do this with Emma McCarthy, who, while recently in Dublin, spoke to the youth officer for this Congress, François David Freschi. He told her all about a project which is designed especially for young people, while in communion, obviously, with the general programme. And, as Emma is about to tell us, goes by the theme, Go, Be Church with Christ and One Another. But let's listen to her interview.
You are the Youth Development Officer, the Youth Programme Officer for the IEC 2012, which is going to introduce a novelty to the International Eucharistic Congress programmes. Your job is to introduce this novelty. It's going to be a specific project aimed at young people to get them motivated and encouraged. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. It's the first time that an International Eucharistic Congress organizes a specific program for young people. There are International Eucharistic Congress every 4 years somewhere in the world, and it's really the first time there is a specific project for young people. So the Congress is really a journey which is proposed to young people. It's a very big week, a big gathering. A Congress is first a gathering, which is very important, but there is also a whole journey of faith and life which is proposed to them. So before the Congress and after it, there is a youth program which is proposed to gather in their parish, to gather in their youth movement and so on, and a guide to follow to get in order to get prepared to the Congress. And so, of course, this preparation program is focused on the preparation to the Congress, the main week, which is the biggest part, which is the Congress itself. And during this big gathering, where we expect 25,000 people a day and 80,000 for the last day in Croke Park, there will be a specific space dedicated to young people. So the main target group is the 17 to 25 years of age. But of course, there won't be any guard in the entrance to check the passport. So if you have younger or older people who would like to come to, they are welcome. Also, I would say if they are too young or too old, the program wouldn't be focused on them. So, and it's also important that the young people must be accompanied with the parents for the reasons of young people under 17 for the child protection laws in Ireland.
So you have a specific program for young people during that week of the Congress, which obviously will have specifically geared talks, workshops. You've been given a very difficult job, though, because we can't deny the fact that in recent years, the church in Ireland, and particularly the church in Dublin, is seeing the consequences of increased secularisation. Also, the reaction of scandal of sex abuse that has swept the church. And as a result, youth participation in the church in Ireland, particularly in big cities like Dublin, is very small. Your job is very difficult.
Well, I think your people will be present if they realize that's really an event which can take an important place in their life, and they won't be the same after the Congress than they were before. I'd say the church calls them to gather, like they called old Christians to gather for this Congress. And behind the church, we believe that Jesus Christ and through His Holy Spirit want to tell them, I have something that I want for you. I have a project of love for you. And the fact for them to come to the Congress would help them to really live a specific, a strong, a joyful, and an intense experience that they will never forget. And so that's true, in order to support this experience. But we have a full program. A full program is interactive catechesis, with workshops, with dramas, with little sharing groups, with testimonies, with specific prayer, like a Thésée prayer in the presence of Brother Alois from Thésée and a few other brothers from Thésée. We'll have also a specific reconciliation night with adoration and so on. So, and we'll have concerts. We'll have a little skills party where young people from different countries from the world will be able to come on the stage and to do a dance or sketch from the drama from their own country. So we'll have many things. But And that is really necessary, and that shows really the will of the Congress to target specifically young people and to tell them, you are a part of the church and your role in the church is really important. But I'd say the most important is the work that Jesus wants to make in the heart. All of that is only there to support that. And it's what's beautiful in the project, because it's the only part that we cannot master, but in the same time, that's the most important one.
But another important aspect, perhaps, is for young Irish people to realise they're not alone in struggling through life and they're not alone in struggling with their faith. And this is why the participation of other young people from other countries is so vitally important. You spoke about bringing a little of the World Youth Day enthusiasm to the International Eucharistic Congress, as we can't hope to bring all of it. I mean, it's a global, massive gathering, but just a little. How would you encourage the young people from French-speaking countries to come and help Irish young people on their way?
Well, it wouldn't be only French-speaking young people who'd have to encourage Irish people, but the opposite as well. I think the church is really a universal adventure. People gathering from every country, it's something amazing. For those who already had the experience of the World Youth Days or European TSE meetings or any other big, or European or from other continent as well, TSE meetings. People who have this experience of big gatherings with many languages, we have several official languages for the Congress, with many countries, with many continents involved, they know that it's something that cannot be replaced by anything else. It's really a unique experience, and it's very important. We have the Cardinal in Belgium, who's just retired as a previous Archbishop, said that a Christian alone is a Christian in danger. And that's very important, this aspect of gathering. A Congress first is a gathering. And the fact that it's gathering, it's not only for Irish people, but for people from every country in the world, even if we won't have all the countries, but we'll have quite a lot. That's something really important, because it's like that we can really make church. It's like that we can really be church. And like the title of our program for young people during the Congress says, go and be church with Christ as one another. And here we have an occasion, an opportunity to live that in an international way.
And our thanks there go to François-David Fresky, Youth Officer, for the 50th forthcoming International Eucharistic Congress, which will take place in Dublin next June. Thanks too to Eamon McCarthy for this interview with him. Finally, do watch the change of pace and tone as our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who is currently teaching in the United States, but spent most of his life as papal Latinist serving under many popes, is about to tell us a little bit about the tradition of spiritual exercises in the Vatican. Prompted by me, of course. Father, when one feels one's not worth a pin, it may be time to do one's spiritual exercises. How would you translate that?
Well, cum se quis sentit a nihili esse, nihili esse. Tunc tempus est ut exercitia spiritualia faciat.
To find light at the end of a tunnel.
Ut lumen in extremo cuniculo reperiat. That you can, all this stuff is easy, that's easy.
So as to change our spiritual lives in a twinkling of an eye.
Ictu oculi, the famous twinkling of an eye. Ut ictu oculi vitam nostram spiritualem mutare possimus.
And give our spiritual lives a bit of spit and polish.
Spit and polish, my lord. Oh, per polire, you'd probably say to just polish. They wouldn't say that. The Romans wouldn't say that, but anyway.
They wouldn't be so vulgar.
No, they wouldn't. They would vitam nostram spiritualem perficiamus. Although spit and polish would be per poliamus, that we polish off our spiritual lives, but these Cicero wouldn't understand that expression. It's just something else.
At any rate, now I want to speak about something serious, which is spiritual exercises in the Vatican, a practice which began in 1929, the year of the Lateran Pax.
I didn't know that.
With Pius XI, obviously, who admired St. Ignatius. Well, how does one say spiritual exercises?
Well, the exercitia spiritualia. That's
that comes from straight from Latin.
Yes, actually, yes. The first translations of Saint Ignatius in Latin had that.
In my Catholic school, we used to say we would go on retreat.
Yeah, retreat is ad recessum. Recessum spiritualem ire. Recessum, to go in the background. That we can say, it's very beautiful. So the fact is, the way I live is in recessu perpetuo. I'm always on some sort of a retreat because, like, I'm all alone in my room. That's a recessu, to be off.
At any rate, the people who live in the Vatican, headed by the Pope, they go on spiritual exercises each year.
He goes on exercises.
The Pope goes on spiritual exercises.
Yes, and then they accompany him.
And the papal household accompanies him. That's the correct terminology, the papal household. How does one say papal household?
Well, that's the Domus Pontificia, the pontifical house.
In 1922, there was an apostolic constitution, Summorum Pontificum. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, so far.
In which St. Ignatius was proclaimed patron of spiritual exercises. You mentioned St. Ignatius tied to spiritual exercises, no?
Yes.
In fact, many of the preachers of these retreats in the papal household were Jesuits.
Yes, and that's the terminology came down from that. I'd like to know, you don't know any of the next words of Summorum Pontificum.
No.
But my students would go crazy over that kind of a beginning of a pontifical document of the Roman pontiffs. And of course, in Latin, you don't know what's happening.
Why?
Well, because you don't know how the sentence is going to end. The will of the Roman pontiffs, the custom of the Roman pontiffs, but the document begins with Summorum Pontificum. We love that kind of stuff.
In other words, you understand the meaning, you have to read the whole sentence.
Well, certainly. You ask my students, they'll club you on the head if you don't give them that answer.
How do you say club you on the head in Latin?
Te verberabunt in capite.
At any rate, the retreats, the spiritual exercises in the Vatican were frequent but not annual until basically 1929, when there was an encyclical, Mens Nostra, which focused on spiritual exercises, right?
There's Mens Nostra. There's another beautiful. Go on.
Tell me, the Mens Nostra.
Our mind, our mentality, our thought. Our thought, Mens Nostra.
Just in two words.
And
the people who take part in the spiritual exercises, they don't speak Latin, do they?
No.
It takes place in Italian.
Yes, well, many of them could or would or should. They should be able, but they...
One of the things that Pius XI, who was Pope at the time, said in that encyclical is that the great disease of the modern era is the lack of reflection. This was 1929.
Poof, we can imagine today.
How would you translate that?
I don't know what he said.
The great disease of the modern era.
Ergo nescio maxima egritudo recensioris aetatis est, is what?
Is the lack of reflection.
Est manca, well, parva deliberatio, parva contemplatio.
Since then, spiritual exercises have taken place in the Vatican almost annually, not always. During the Second Vatican Council, they were suspended, I think, for a while. But curiously, Pope John XXIII held the exercises once, just right ahead of the Second Vatican Council, in the tower in the Vatican Gardens. John XXIII loved the gardens in the Vatican, and it was like he was leading all the papal household up the garden path.
Yeah, I don't think he was leading, but anyway... He was there, and maybe they came up there.
At any rate, what I'm getting at is, how do you say in Latin, leading someone up the garden path, which Pope John wasn't doing?
Per hortorum semitam ducebat pontificiam domum. Leading house.
Whereas, to lead someone up the garden path, in British English, is to deceive, to trick, to entice with false promises of fair prospects.
That's all right, but it's British.
Yeah, which isn't what John the 23rd was doing, but how do you say that in Latin? Sorry.
Well, that would be decipere or fallere or fraudari or frustrari. There are many words to deceive.
At the time of Pope Pius the 12th, a complaint was lodged, I believe, by Papa Pacelli himself that the preacher was delivering what he referred to in Italian as a nobile mattone, which I'm quoting
a
someone.
A noble brick? What does that mean?
He was saying that it was very heavy going. How would you translate the Italian, you know, nobile?
Well, if you want to say nobile mattone is later nobilis, which doesn't make any sense at all in Latin, but that's all right.
How would you give the gist of...
Bravi or sermo, it was rather heavy talk.
We were talking about John the 23rd Tower in the Vatican Gardens, but actually the spiritual exercises today take place in the Redemptoris Mater chapel. That's a chapel with a Latin name.
Mm-hmm. Redemptoris Mater.
Which means?
Mother of the Redeemer, which is the title of his encyclical on the Blessed Mother.
Pope John Paul's encyclical. Actually, before becoming Pope, when he was Archbishop of Krakow, he preached one of the retreats, one of the spiritual exercises. Becoming one of the first non-Italians to preach in the Vatican.
Go on.
Do you think the fact that many of the cardinals now come from different countries right across the world, do you think that changes the use of Latin within the church?
Certainly it has, in the sense that many of these people might not know Latin well enough. Many of these people were trained here in Rome, got it? And so Italian is more accessible and easier for them. And so it's
also because, I mean, Latin is part of our Western cultural heritage, but some of these people don't come from...
I have Orientals who know Latin very, very well, but you have to be trained, you see. And some of these people, even the Orientals, would feel more at home with Italian. Oh, they say, oh, to think of Latin would be like a headache for them. Which is very unfortunate. I have friends, when I meet them, we start speaking Latin immediately, you see. And the general of my order, and I hadn't seen him for, 25 years. And we just started speaking Latin. That was the end of it.
And heartfelt thanks there to our popular Latin lover, he's Carmelite, Reginald Foster, who's currently teaching in the United States, but as I said a moment ago, spent most of his life as papal Latinist. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, bringing you a reflection by Dominican preacher and poet, Father Paul Murray, which has as title, What is it like to come close to the presence of God? Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website for other stories, the address is www.vaticanradio.org and then click on the English World icon. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.